If you're going to be in Chicago this August, I want to tell you about the Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive that I'm going to be teaching. If you're a seasoned improviser and you're looking for a new approach to improv and you'd like to play more real, grounded scenes, then I'd love to work with you. I limit this workshop to only 14 people, so you get personal attention, and I'll be offering it here in Chicago at Stage 773 on the weekend of August 10th through 11th. And if you sign up before July 27th, you'll save $30 on this workshop. For more information or to register, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Also, if you're an actor and you've always wanted to try improv, or you're just new to improv, I will be offering my six-week class, The Artist Low Comedy Level 1, at Green Shirt Studio starting September 11th. To sign up or for more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and we have another great episode of Improv Nerd for you. Our guest today is Jay Succo. Now, Jay is one of the best improvisers and teachers out there today. I believe he's taught at every institution here in Chicago. He currently lives in Los Angeles, where he teaches at the West Side in Santa Monica and for the Second City in Los Angeles. Recently, he was the artistic director at the ICC Theater in Copenhagen. And we talked to Jay originally 5 years ago on the podcast, but a lot has changed in improv and a lot has changed with Jay. So we were lucky enough to catch up with him in Chicago at Green Shirt Studio. We talked to Jay about why it's so important for him to make positive choices on stage and why he goes out of his way to avoid anger, how he still brings joy to improv after all these years, and how he's been able to adapt in the classroom as a teacher in these changing times. Before we get to the episode with Jay, usually I have a little monologue here, but I'm just doing this one-man show. I'm just really bored about talking about myself, and I think you'll find in this interview with Jay, I'm a little more revealing than I've been in past interviews. I don't know if that's going to be a trend or not, so let me know what you think. In a kind way, please, I'm very sensitive to criticism. So that being said, let's get to this interview. Here it is. You're just going to love this interview. Jay is so, he's got such great philosophies, and hopefully I learned a thing or two. Here it is, the Jay Succo interview. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Jay Succo, thank you for being our guest at Improv Nerd.
Jimmy, what's up?
You know, we did this. The last time we did this was 5 years ago, and a lot has changed. You were a guest on Improv Nerd, and a lot has changed in your life, in my life.
Yep.
A lot has changed in improv. Mm-hmm. And after that episode, you then moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah, not like the episode ended and I moved, but.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to take responsibility yes. for that. I wanted to, you know. You move to Los Angeles, and then all of a sudden you decide you're going to be the artistic director at the ICC Theater in Copenhagen. So tell me, because we were talking before about, and I had the same thing, as we'd go in a theater that wasn't ours, and we'd want to change things.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, if only I was in charge.
Right,
you know,
right.
I would. So what did you learn now actually getting this opportunity to be the artistic director? What were some of the good things about it, and what were some of the challenges?
Going into it, because I had experience at other theaters in a similar position, I was like, okay, I had learned from that experience. And then I sat, and it was a hard decision because I knew, like, I kind of weighed the pros and cons. And what really attracted me to it was could I lead a theater artistically the way I think makes it most enjoyable.
And what is that? What is your mission?
Oh, well, my mission in life is to have everyone take one improv class. And also
how close are you to accomplishing that?
Well, now I'm a lot closer.
Okay.
I was over there for 7 months.
You're going to do a country by country? How is your strategy?
Yeah. First, Europe. Okay. I'm pretty solid there. Okay. And now I'm going to go Asia, and I'll get pretty solid there. I think, like, the way I look at it is we make things really complicated as humans. And if you just go back to the first two words you learn, which are yes and. People ask me, like, when are you going to write a book? Like, and not people, like, clamoring, but people have come up to me, and they're like, you should write a book, an improv book. And I go, I've already written it. It's one page. You open it up. It says yes and then that's it. It's just giant letters.
I want to ask you something, because getting to play with you, you know, and knowing you more this year, you bring so much joy when you improvise. And my question to you is, what is your definition of yes and? Do you agree to everything that's been said?
Yeah, well, I look at it like it's always a yes to it. Now, there are situations when you get with nervous performers or newer performers or things like that, and they do things that are inappropriate. And to me, I'm like, I'm not going to choose to be like, this inappropriate thing, I'm going to yes and for sure. But I'm definitely, when I'm up there, I'm like, absolutely. Like, I look at my partner like they're always right. They always have the answer. They always say the thing where it's like, yeah, absolutely. And when somebody says, like, let's say, for example, in a scene, someone's like, oh, man, you are fat. I'm going to be like, absolutely, I am. And then I can choose to do what I want to with that. It depends on who I play with. For some people, I might be like, oh, yeah, but I just can't stop eating my feelings. For some people, I might be like, oh, yeah, but I'm finally carrying my weight well. Like, whatever it is, I'm not going to negotiate with what they give me. So I think it's so much easier just to be like, yeah. Like, and go watch shows and watch how many times people just say no. Like, a scene will be, hey, you want something to drink? And they'll go, no. And I'm like, why? Why? Why don't you just say yes? So whatever the thing is, it's like when you say yes, I think the and is more important, actually. But the yes, when you say yes, what you're saying to them is, yes, I hear you. Like, and you go, yeah, absolutely, I hear you. And so whatever the person says to me, if somebody in a scene says to me, like, I want a divorce, I'll be like, oh, thank God. Yep, you should. I've been emotionally distant, and it's time for me to head out. But thank you for saying that. You're very brave. Like that to me allows so much more fun to happen. We said to an audience, you're saying, come watch us take a suggestion from you, and you're going to challenge us with that suggestion to come up with something cool together. And if you can play with that joy and say, yeah, what you're saying is a great idea. And if you can continue to say that, it just makes it so much easier. I'm not saying my way is the right way. I'm saying, like, it's a bigger hit rate for me. It's making it easier. It's like anybody who's taken a class with me knows most of my notes are, what's the answer? It just is always like, say yes. Like, that's always the case. And people want to get angry. I don't understand why. Why are you choosing to be angry in a scene? Like, I don't get that. And it might work for some people. And I tell students, and I encourage teachers all the time, too, to let students know your way is not the right way. It's just, this works for me. And this is something I've
because
seen.
We don't agree on anger. Like, I believe that you can use anger in a scene. You just have to agree through it, you know?
And I look at it like, anger's fun if I'm directing it at myself. Me to direct anger at my partner is, like, it's not up to them to take on my anger. It's like having anger at myself or anger at something that you shouldn't be angry at is super fun. Like, I do that. I love that, where it's like, make yourself look like the fool. But to be angry at my partner, to me, I just, maybe it's a preference too, I just don't want to play that. I don't want to play where it's like, oh, let's get mad at each other. Because I feel like, who leaves a show going, hey, that was a great argument. You both held your point of view. Nobody changed. Wow, you restated your point of view several times. I'm like, there's enough of that in life. I have enough anger, all of that stuff. So my thing and what I love playing with are people who it's like play. And it's like, let's play and let's get silly. And the people I like playing with the most are the people that enjoy it. Now, they can use anger in a comedic way, which it gets very... It's hard to understand how to use anger comedically when it's not at your partner. Like somebody like Carell does it really well because he makes himself look like the fool. But and again, yeah,
Steve Carell.
It's like he plays that way, and some people can play anger really well because they look foolish. And that to me, I'm like, yeah, if I'm going to be angry, I'm going to make myself look silly. But
so let's talk about the joy piece. With you is like, how have you been able to tap into the joy? Is that something you grew up with, or is that something you learned in comedy sports? Where did you learn it? And I don't think, because I've known you a while, I don't think. I would be curious to know when you developed it in improv, because as I remember, like all of us, there was rough spots and bitter spots in improv. And
oh, yeah. And I think like maybe part of it, too, is like I've already done those scenes. I think part of it is comedy sports you mentioned, which like really helped me as a performer because it's a short form improv show, which also forces you to play clean and you can't play dirty and you don't really have time to have like an argument because you have to resolve it quickly. I think part of it is also I have friends who, like Craig Euler is a guy who is really a joy to watch and people love watching him. And he has a story where he auditioned for Second City for the touring company for years. And finally somebody said to him, if you don't get angry at this audition, you'll get the job. And he didn't get angry and he got the job. Like there are so many people where it's like, I think you just eventually learn like, oh, that's a lot of work. If I'm at a bad place in my personal life, it's so much harder to remember to leave that off stage. So sometimes it's like a personal life happens. Like sometimes I like years ago, I would go through bad stuff off stage and I would carry that on stage. And it was like, oh, it was very easy to tap into that, but it also was very boring. I think anger is boring to watch. I had a teacher once, Gene Villapique, who said, I was with a friend of mine improvising, a really good friend, and it was at a, I'll never forget the scene. We're at a coffee shop, and I start in on an argument, and this was 15 years ago probably, and she stops and she goes, do you like each other off stage? I'm like, we're like best friends. She goes, oh, like each other on stage. And I went, oh, because it allows positive choices to me are more interesting scenes and allows scenes to go places.
Well, yeah. And I think there's what I'm starting to realize is there's in comedy, you need tension. Mm-hmm. And I think
tension for sure.
You know, what you're talking about is like, there's nothing worse than watching like someone start with a problem in a scene.
Right.
And I think people think, well, if we like each other, there's not going to be tension. But what I'm finding is it's there. The tension is there, even if we're agreeing on something.
100%. And you said it. It's like I think anger, people go conflict, and we go tension.
Right.
And awkward silences are super fun. Tension is really fun to play as you go. And so I think you have to just go through a bunch of these scenes, too. And for some people, it's like, great, I know performers are like, okay, you'll never lose that anger, and that's fine, but it will limit what you can do. And also, when you get into improv, is it like your first day you go home and you go, oh, you talk to your friend or significant other, and you're like, guess what? I got to argue today, and oh, boy, was that fun. No, you go, it's a joy, and it's play, and we forget that because we have this sense of joy when we warm up before a show. And then sometimes we walk on stage when we're doing long form improvisation and we go, now let's improvise. And we bring all that joy and we put it to the side and we get out there and we get a suggestion and we forget all the stuff that makes improv wonderful, which is like you say something and then I'll build on that. Like that's yes and. You say your thing. I go, what a great idea. And let me add to it. And now we're building this thing together. But instead, sometimes we're like, John Hildreth said it. He goes, yeah, every year improvisers think no is a good idea. And it's like, right? And it's like, it's so true. Like, we think, oh, this, now that we have this problem, now that we're arguing, now we have something to improvise about. Now this is interesting. It's like, no. Watching two people up on stage enjoy each other's company is super rewarding for an audience. You didn't, unless your show is billed as we're doing a conflict show, if you're billing your show as improv or comedy, improv comedy, then you have to deliver that to your audience. And when you do it and you say, come out and watch this show where we, and you tell your, you know, you tell your people before the show, oh, we love each other. You talk to your group. It's like, we love each other so much. But then you get up there and you get mad at each other. It doesn't connect for me. It's like, well, you support each other off stage and you have so much fun off stage, but then you get on stage and you forget that. And you're like, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a problem. And it's like, okay, eventually I think a lot of improvisers go, oh, that's a lot of work. And then you circle back to like, it took me 20 years to be like, oh, I just want to play with my friends. And like playing with you, I love playing with you because like you're super fun to play with. And I love playing with like John Hildreth. Like John rarely, I don't remember John arguing, at least like playing together, or like Micah Philbrook or any of those people. And it's like, it's really fun. I like playing with people who want to engage in arguments. I really do, because I won't, and I'll deflect it. And our friend, we have a friend, Bill Baylor, who will say to somebody on stage, like I've seen him do this. He just goes, yeah, I'm not going to fight with you. Like he just says it. And then if they start to fight, he'll just walk off stage.
Well, I think it's interesting that, because the last time 5 years ago when we did Improv Nerd, I had a blast. My wife was at the show and she's like, you know, Jay's really a good guy to play with because he gets you out of your comfort zone. Because I will, you know, I will use anger and I'm, you know, it's interesting that we come from different, kind of different points of view, yet we can still work together, you know?
Why do you think you like to do anger?
I think that, I think it was always an easy, I think I got laughs on it when I started early. So it was kind of a hard thing to let go of. And then I think the other thing, in the more I teach, the more I realize this, and it's a life thing, is that so your point of view of like, oh, there's no anger in improv, I would look at that and say, well, that's not realistic. We're not showing life.
You're right.
Which is really my outlook in life. Like, sure. I'm a guy, and you saw my show, my one-man show. Yeah. I'm someone who has a hard time in life finding joy. I ain't going to find it on stage, you know? I mean, it's not because I can't find it in life, it's not miraculously going to show up on stage. So it was, I think part of it is just my outlook, and that's what I'm starting to see.
Yeah.
That you can't, you know, your outlook in your life is very important to how you the choices you make on stage.
Yeah, and I'll challenge you and say, like, if you're saying that, then you're not going to find it. If you're like, if you're putting out there where it's like, I just can't, or that's not, then it's like, great, you won't, because you're going to, your brain and your ego will say like, see, I'm right, I won't. But if you say, or you allow yourself to, because when we're on stage and we played a bunch,
yeah,
it's all fun.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, it is a different side of you playing that. But if you challenge yourself to be, like I would say, what would you tell a student to do in that situation?
Well, it all depends on the
what if a student's like, oh, Jimmy, I just keep going angry. I don't want to go angry. What do I do? What would you tell them?
Well, I would just say, let's experiment. Let's make positive choices. Now,
okay.
That's, you know, and when, so certainly I've been learning from my students to do that, you know, but I, you know.
And I would say, like, if you, and the other thing too is like, if you want to, then you can do it. But if it's like, oh, I don't want to do it, it's like, okay. And that, and again, like that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's like, you know, I can't do it. It's like, well, I mean, you can do it. It's just, do you want to do it? Do you want to play that way? And I think a lot of people think like they're very scared to make those choices. They're very scared to be like, if I make a positive choice, like nothing's happening. It's like, no, like if you sit there, Elaine May, who is to me on the Mount Rushmore of like just improvisers, says, when in doubt, seduce. And Amy Poehler, who is probably also up there, is like, I choose to fall in love with my scene partner before they start. And if you poll an audience, if you ask an audience after a show and you put an improviser up there, who did you enjoy? And this is a non-improviser, just somebody off the street, never seen improv. They're going to choose the people who have joy. It's a contagious thing. And when you have joy, it allows things to happen.
So let's take this joy concept. Is like
Jimmy is rubbing his eyes right now. Right. Jimmy, you are rubbing your
forehead. Well, because here's the thing. You came and you saw my one-person show. And I got to tell you something. I struggle having fun. You know, here's this great show that I've written. And struggle having fun and bringing joy to something that I've created. So what is the secret to that?
Well, why do you think you struggle with it?
I put a lot of pressure on myself, just like students put a lot of pressure on themselves. And it's how do you let go of that pressure? How do you let go of the expectation? And we've seen it, right? You know, like, oh, I'm going to be cut from a team or, you know, I want to go to the next level.
I think, like, there's a saying I learned from my buddy Tony Llewellyn, who is out now in L.A., and he learned it from someone. And Tony's one of these guys that you look on stage and it's like, he's one of those dudes that doesn't have to say anything. Like, he just comes out and just, every time he talks, it's just like, he just crushes it. And he goes, I release and destroy my need to do a good improv show. Release and destroy it. And you think about it. When I go on stage, sometimes a lot of times before I get to the stage, I say to myself, shut up, brain, I'm going to play. Like, I tell myself that. I also try to visualize it. Here's the other thing. It's a lot of the stuff that sometimes people roll their eyes at, where it's like positive affirmation and visualizing it. Like, a lot of some people go, that doesn't work. It's like, cool, cool. If you want that, that's great. But for me, it does. So some of the stuff I'm like, I know it might sound like granola or crunchy or any of that stuff, but for me, it works. So then I go, okay. And then when I have fun on stage, I go, what made me have fun there? And then a couple of things, I try to remember it. Sometimes it's like, oh, I have to listen to music to put me in a mood right there. Sometimes it's like when I warm up, I have to get silly before I play. Like, that to me gets me in a state of play as we go. I have to look and go, oh, what you do in this improv show, I have to constantly remind myself of, like, that's what's supposed to happen. Like, what you're supposed to do, now it's up to me to, what do I want to do to play with it? And I've been on teams where it's like they're doing some group game, and I think it's like just inappropriate humor. So I'm like, I'll edit this. Like, I'm not going to go on because I won't enjoy myself. I can still be a part of the show, and I can still step back and be like, hey, you do that thing, that's great. But what can I do? How can I control I can't control what they do. I can't control what you do on stage. So, I can control what I do.
I mean, I think this point is a good one, because I think more and more improv people have different points of view. You know, I'm a guy who uses anger. You're a guy who doesn't use anger. But it goes beyond that, because people have different approaches. And I know, you know, you have UCB style, and you have Annoyance style, and Second City style, and I.O. style, and, you know, Pack Theater style. You have all these different styles. And I think people get locked in. It's like, well, if Jay does it this way,
totally.
You know, that's the right way to do it. Or if Jimmy does it this way, that's the right way to do it. And then when we play together, how do you let go of that and say, okay, that's what Jay does and that's what Jimmy does. And Jimmy's going to learn from Jay. And Jay will probably learn from Jimmy.
We'll definitely learn from you.
So how do we exist? How does improvisers let go of that judgment of, like, I'm coming from the right school. This is how it should be played.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. One is, these are, you know, tools, not rules. You get up there and it's like, you have these skills. Now it's up to you to do what you want to do up there. Nobody has the right answer. I go back again to, like, I don't know, the easiest thing to do is say yes as you get up there and be like, okay, great. You do your thing. Replace judgment with curiosity. Replace the yes and means no judgment. That's the first thing. So for you to judge what your partner does in a scene is against what this whole thing we're doing is based on, which is no judgment. You get into it because of no judgment.
But it's easy to say no judgment. I'm a very judgmental person. I will not only judge your choice,
of course,
I will judge my choice. So that judgment, the judgmental choice comes there. Oh, Jay's playing a pirate again. I fucking hate playing pirates. What do I do? How do I turn that into curiosity?
There's a couple simple techniques. One is you say to yourself, oh, that's exactly what's supposed to happen now. That pirate thing is supposed to happen now. when you're judging like a pirate move, right? You're in that space of what you're saying to your partner is, what a terrible choice. What a terrible use of your imagination. And that's not your space to say. It is not. Here's the thing. That's not your call to make. Your call to make is not like judging what your partner is doing. That's, again, it goes back to keep it real simple. Yes, and. So you look at it and you go, cool, they're playing a pirate. What are my choices? I can leave the scene. But you're spending, it's, you know, it's like you're spending energy mad at me for what I'm doing. So you're out of the scene already. You're very passive at that point. You're like, ugh, another pirate. It's like, cool. Then here's what you can do. Don't play with that person again. Go find the people. If you want to be in a group where it's people are doing whatever it is, find those people. Like, there's all these things work. And everything I say, there's more than a million examples of the opposite.
But
work.
I don't think that would help me, because I think if you're going to be a pirate, I think as an improviser, it's my job to work with it.
And I would say here's a thing you could do in that scene. When somebody's a pirate and your first thought is, oh, my God, no. I would say be more of a pirate right away. Just be like, I'm going to be more of the thing you're doing. That way I'm accepting what it is.
So let's say you're the pirate. Do the scene, right?
Yeah.
And you're saying I have to be a bigger pirate than you?
I mean, I'm saying that's one thing you can do.
Okay.
One thing you can do is that. Another thing you can do is put all your focus on your partner and be like, what are they doing? They're a pirate. So what goes with a pirate? How can I get them to be more of a pirate? Now you're not in your head, because what you're doing is when you're in that space, you're in your head. Mm-hmm. When you're in a judgment space. And judgment cannot exist with creativity. They can't exist in the same space.
What if you use that judgment and put it into your character?
Is that working for you?
Well, sometimes it does, yeah.
And I'd say, like, if it's working for you, then keep doing it. But for me, I'm like, I want to make it as easy as I can. Mm-hmm. And for me, at this point in my life as an improviser, what makes it easiest for me that always works is being like, great move. I always leave a scene when I'm like, oh, you're a pirate? Where do I fit in this world of pirate? Because I'm not thinking, I'm not planning. I'm like, what's your thing? Let me take it and run with it. And I'm also at a point, too, where I feel pretty comfortable going, I'll be fine in this scene. And, I don't know where I heard it from, but somebody was like, yeah, of all the scenes I've done, that was one of them. Of all the shows you've done, that was the most recent. Like, you're going to do a ton more.
Right.
And if you fuck up the scene, who cares? Nobody's going to come up to you. Or, I mean, I shouldn't say nobody. Nobody's come up to me going like, hey, about 8 years ago, there was a pirate scene. Mm-hmm. And you really fucked up that pirate scene. And I wanted to talk to you about it. It's like, no. It's like, no, it's gone. That's the fun of improv. It's gone. When you have a pirate and a second pirate joins, there's power in numbers. And if we're both weird, nobody's weird. But if I make a move and I go, arg, and I might be thinking, why the fuck am I doing this? I don't fucking know. Fuck, I'm nervous. I'm scared. This came out. And then I have my partner who goes, don't be that way. Now I'm beating myself up twice over this move that I don't know why the fuck I made this. This sound came out of my mouth and I don't want, oh, fuck, please. I want to hide. But then I have a partner give me that sideways fisheye look of like, ugh. And then it's like, now where's that scene going to go? Nowhere. So now it's going to, you might get rewarded. What's happening is you might get rewarded because your argument or your anger is getting laughs, but it's destroying what is special to me of improv, which is us building something together. And at the scene going like, that was so much fun versus like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You got a laugh. Nice job. Cool. Yeah. Oh, that show you want me to do later. I can't do it. I'm busy because I don't want to play with that. At this point for me, I'm going to have fun in a scene no matter what. So if you are in a scene and you're judging my pirate thing, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do more of it. If you're like, stop
well,
with
then,
that.
But I think right there, then you have, you know, there's some built-in tension there.
Right.
You know?
Because I'm also like if I tell you stop being the pirate thing, I'm not adding to the scene, really. I'm telling you what to do.
Right.
But if it's like knowing, like playing with you, there are tension. I know we played a bunch of times, so I know how to play with you, and I know what's going to be fun in this situation.
Right.
And in a situation where you're like you choose to be angry or grumpy or whatever, I'm going to be like, yeah, like I'm not going to try and stop you from being that way. I'm going to, like, for you, I'll be like, oh, and here's another reason you should be angry, Jimmy. Like in the scene, I'll be like, keep doing that thing, man. Like I'm down with that. And the people I like playing with too, and the people I like watching play with that. And I have to remind myself, and I'm like, oh my goodness, that person plays with so much joy. I have to remember that. And you remind yourself and you come out of it. And it's like, okay, you go into, you know, I also have to look at like, what am I wearing on stage? Because sometimes if I wear pants that are too, like a half size too small, I don't feel good. You know, like I eat something bad before the show, I don't feel good. So I have to keep that in mind. It's like, I have to get myself in a headspace to be like, play. Even, and it's so hard when you have bad stuff going on in your life to get to that point sometimes. But writing, you know, things like writing things out like a gratitude list or like, man, what if this is the last time I play with this person? How would I play with them? Anytime a team that I've experienced, I've been in a situation where it's like, oh, a team's cut. Their last show or two shows are always the best because they don't care anymore and they just have fun. You know, and that's the other thing. It's like, what audience member is going to go, hey, Jimmy, less fun, more art. They don't. They're like, you have. Wow, that was really fun, and it's not at the expense of the audience, but it's watching people have joy.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. If you want to be great at improv, you've got to bring some acting to it. And you have to believe that before you can be funny, you need to be real. And that is what the Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensive is all about. It's about working organically off your partner, slowing down, taking them in the first couple seconds before you get on stage, and getting everything you need to make a strong initiation off your partner. It's about bringing an emotional life to your improvisation, which is good acting. It's also about doing it one line at a time. The whole ping pong analogy, you know, you hit the ping pong, you wait for it to come back. I've seen it way too much in improv, and I've taught all around the country. Everybody's trying to monologue their way to improv, trying to find something funny to say. No. We respond to the last thing that our partner said, and we build off that. And when we do that, we surprise ourselves, and we surprise our partners. And you know what? We even surprise our audience. And when you take this pressure off yourself to be so funny and to be so clever, all of a sudden, improv becomes as easy as having a conversation. If you want to work this way, you want to work a little more real and grounded, you want to tap into some honesty about yourself in your scene work, then I want to work with you. I will be teaching the Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensive in August, the weekend of August 10th through 11th here at Chicago. It's stage 773. I limit this to 14 people, so you get personal attention. Now, if you sign up before July 27th, you'll save $30 on this workshop. For more information or to sign up, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. When we talked the last time, you mentioned something that was interesting, and you said improvisers, you know, the goal for improvising is to get paid. Now, mm-hmm. That was 5 years ago. Has that changed?
I mean, that could be a goal. Some people, it's not their goal. Some people, it's like, this is just a hobby. Like, I think improv should be paid as much as actors. I really do. I think we won't get there until people stop setting up improv to fail and being like, we're doing make-em-ups, or this is just, again, my personal opinion, showing up dressed down, the audience dresses better, and you're showing up and you're just screwing around. Like, you can still have fun and everything, but I think once you start treating it like it's more like you're taking more pride in it, I think you can start seeing getting paid.
To me, that almost seems, when you tell me that, like what you learned at Comedy Sports. Because Comedy Sports, to me, of all the improv, and I had a lot of judgment about short form, but it was very disciplined. Dick Chudnow, like, had this formula, not how to treat the audience. This is what we're going to say on stage. You know, we're really looking out for the audience. And we're, you know, Comedy Sports, at least in Chicago, I don't know if it's still, they gave, you got something for doing a show. There was, and the other thing that I really appreciated was, and I'd like to know your opinion about this, is comedy sports in short form seems to appeal to a mainstream audience, and that's different than long form shows, which seems to appeal to improv student audiences.
100%.
And I think there's a different skill that you learn when you play to a mainstream audience.
Yeah, and I think I think I really learned about that at Second City, because when I started there, it's like you would do shows in suits, you know, and so it was a thing of like dressing up, and then I did do comedy sports, and it was you'd go out and say the audience would be made up of people who hadn't seen improv, and you would do long form, and it's like, long form is good for improvisers. The difference with long and short form is short form, somebody comes out and says, here's what we're doing, and everybody's on the same page. The actors know, the audience. Immediately, there's no question. And it's also like you have tension because you have 3 to 4 to 5 minutes. So it's like, and then it's like, here's a goal. When a word is said, this person leaves the stage. When it's said again, they come back on. Everybody knows. The audience is ahead of you, the audience. And in long form, we forget that aspect of it. So we don't think the audience is smart a lot of times, or we ask for a suggestion, we get mad at them. It's like, can I get a suggestion? Pineapple. Ugh. It's like, why are you mad at your audience? Why? And you've done every show there has been about that suggestion? No. But you get a suggestion, and then we have this whole thing of like, well, you should go A to C, which is like, now you've lost the audience because they didn't see you go from A to C. So they're like, what does this have to do with pineapple? And now you're on stage. You don't know what it's a lot of confusion at times. And so that's what loses an audience, is they come out and they're like, I don't quite understand what the suggestion, I don't get it. And we like to complicate things. So we like to, let's do this new form. And it's like, that's low down on the list of why audiences come to see a show. They come to see a show because you're going to entertain them. Like, that's the big thing. And we forget a lot of times an audience comes to see an improv show thinking it's stand-up or already rehearsed. Like, they, even though you say improv, they think sketch or stand-up, so they come out there. But you get a suggestion, now you have a bunch of people who aren't working together, they aren't connected, they don't quite understand what's happening at times. We've all done those group games where it's like, what is this? I don't get it. We've all done the group games where it's like, oh, Game of Thrones characters. I don't know any because I don't know that many of them. Now we're all confused. So we lose the audience, and we forget, like, the audience is the most important people there. Like, it's not your scene partner, it's the audience. Otherwise, do it for no audience. They're there. We have to remember and include them a lot. And I think there is, when any improv is done well, it's great. It doesn't matter if it's long form, short form, but it's all the same game. The difference is in long form, you have to come to that agreement of, oh, this is the game we're playing. This is the tent. This is what it is. You have to come to that, and the audience has to be along with you for that. So I think,
what do you take that you've learned in short form and apply it to long form?
Oh, make quick decisions. That doesn't
mean,
like,
give me an example.
In long form, we like to beat around the bush. Maybe you want to go out with me. I don't know, all that stuff. In long form, it's like, or in short form, it's like, go out with me, let's date, and then we deal with it. So I think that's it. I think a lot of times we, in long form, we'll meander because we don't want to make a decision. Or it's like, I don't want to edit that scene because they're about to get to something. It's like, in short form, it's like, no, you're going more on instinct. You're like, we don't have the time. That doesn't mean frenzied. It just means like, we need to make a decision right now, so let's make a decision and deal with it. And with short form, too, it's like, I think you take bigger risks knowing, oh, if this doesn't go well, we're moving on.
So if you're doing a long form, you get the suggestion of pineapple,
mm-hmm.
and now you're going to be the first scene, what are you going to come out with?
Nothing. I mean, I'm going to know it's pineapple. I'm going to look at you, and mm-hmm. I'm going to look at you, and I'm going to read into something you're doing and be like, okay, cool. I might bring pineapple into the scene.
But how are you going to bring in the short form aspect of it? So if you're saying, I'm not going to meander,
yeah.
we got the first scene, yeah. you and I, and we've got pineapple. Now you're thinking like a short form player in a long form. What's your first move here?
I might do something as simple as like, hey, our daiquiris are ready. Or like pineapple. Or I might say like, oh, I'm gonna make some pineapple. Like, I might do something like that. I might, you know, playing with Bill Baylor, once we got a suggestion of Clementine and we did a 45-minute mono scene, and 40 minutes into the mono scene, I mean, we were in a cabin and it was snowed in, 40 minutes into the mono scene, Baylor goes, hey, I brought some Clementines, and that was 40 minutes into it. With a long form, I will if it's pineapple, let's say, I will go to object work probably first and just be in the middle of something. That's another thing short form taught me, is like just be in the middle of it. So then,
you know, all of a sudden you're cutting up and you're like,
I might be cutting a pineapple. I might be just thinking to myself, if I drink something in the scene, I'll have a pineapple juice. Like I might be doing that. I might be thinking like, it's all your process, you, it's all ideas that you're generating and dropping the whole time. So I might be like, oh, maybe our relationship is prickly. Maybe we're on a boat. Something that I'm like, I want to incorporate that. But then also look at you. I'm looking at your eyes. If it seems like you're not sure or your eyes aren't giving anything, then I'm like, okay, I'll make a choice.
So because I want to understand it for myself. So it's almost like you're looking at me,
yeah,
to get something off me. And then based on that, you're going to make a strong choice, probably something with the environment, but definitely something in the middle of the starting in the middle,
yeah,
of the scene.
Yeah, always. It's like I always want to make a choice. For me, it's again simpler to be like, I'm in the middle of the scene and I know you. Or if you call me a stranger right away, that's fine. Then I just want to connect with you somehow. So I might be like, hey, that's a great shirt. SpongeBob SquarePants, right? And it's like, that's my connection to pineapple. That might be it. But I'm also like, here's the first step of it. Let's see where we go.
And for people that, and I'm one of these people who meander on stage and trying to figure it out.
That's a great term.
What do you think prevents people from just spilling something out?
What do you think?
Well, I'm interviewing you.
Well, I'm going to ask you. I'll tell you mine, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, I can tell you. It's just fear.
It's fear. It's always fear, which goes back again to, like, imagine if you're in a scene. When you play with me, I don't get angry. Hopefully that fear will dissipate a bit because you're like, oh, no matter what happens, I'm not going to be, like, mad at you in a scene. So it's a fear thing, and it's an ego thing. And I never got why people – and I know, like, again, I'm not saying not to do them. But for me, I don't want to be mad at my scene partner. I don't want to be mad at our location. I don't want to be mad at our relationship. I don't want to get out of any of that stuff. I don't want to be mad. I want to be like, how can I explore this? And joy helps the fun come out of it. Watching somebody – if we start a scene, and I'm like, oh, man, Marty, this pineapple tastes fucking great. You gotta try this. You gotta try it. Try it. I know you don't want to try it. I know. Your blood sugar, I know.
Yeah. I'm type 2 diabetic.
I know, but try. All right, don't try it. Watch me try it. Just okay. Watch me enjoy it. Okay. Oh, it's so good.
Go ahead.
Oh, it's so good.
Let me smell it.
Just smell it.
Oh my God!
Right.
Take a piece and then blow.
I'll blow it right in. Open your mouth.
Okay. Oh my God!
So good, right? Dude, so good.
That is like, man, that's like college, man.
Right?
You got high, man.
You want to get high?
Yeah, I'd love to get high.
Let's get fucking high.
Okay.
I'm gonna carve out this pineapple. We'll smoke up in the pineapple.
Bong?
Yeah, we're gonna make a bong, dude. Cool. Smoke the shit out of this, man.
Okay, man.
It's so good.
Okay. All right.
Hit it up.
No, I want.
Okay,
me,
cool.
Like,
yeah, don't hit it up. Don't hit it up. I'll blow it in. I'll shotgun it.
Yeah, shotgun it. So then I won't say that I did. You know what I'm saying? Same thing with the pineapple.
Yeah, you won't have to. You won't have to say you got high because you're not really getting high.
Exactly.
I'm getting high. I'm getting high.
Could you put a piece of pineapple in your
Could
mouth?
Could I piece it? You want me to piece it?
Yes.
Don't fucking
put a piece of pineapple in your mouth.
Okay, I'm gonna put a piece of pineapple in my mouth. Take it.
Oh my God,
it's good, right?
Good. Just smell it.
Just smell it.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, I'm ready. Let me get a little closer so when you blow, I really get to... I'm not getting high, right? I'm not going to get high off this.
I don't know, man. Probably not.
Oh, man, I'm not getting high.
You're not high at all, dude. You're not high. You're not. Just
I
keep saying to yourself,
not,
you're not high. I'm not high.
Did you put egg on my head?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah,
I got egg on my hair. Right? It's good for your hair, man.
Yeah.
Look at that long, flowing. You got locks, dude. I wish I had your hair.
Well,
I wish I had your hair.
That's okay.
It's so okay.
You want to touch my ponytail?
Yeah. Oh,
I know. Touch my ponytail.
It's so good. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. You look good with long hair. Not many people can pull off long hair. Yeah, Put your head on the plate. That's cool. Good. We'll finish them.
I'm so glad
beans.
I didn't eat that pineapple.
I don't.
All right.
Was it fun?
Yeah, it was a blast.
Oh.
You know?
And, like, I think your fear, your human's fear and ego are the things that get in the way. And your ego is like, we got to do something else, or this isn't interesting, or I can't do this, and all of that stuff. And then I think eventually you get to a point, or some people eventually get to a point where it's like, none of that matters. Like, I got into this because it was, A, super fun. It was like a sport. And honestly, it was a dead-end job where it was like, oh, I'm never going to achieve anything with this. Now it's changed, and it's become a career of mine, but in the beginning it was...
So it was kind of... It was, in a way, like, there was comfort knowing that it wasn't going
totally.
Anywhere.
Totally. You know, like, back in the day, it was like, I don't know, Second City, but I didn't want... I liked doing Second City with the people I did it with. I didn't
want... You never wanted to be on main stage?
No. Really? I only wanted... I would only have wanted to be on main stage, honestly, if it was with the people who were in my first group. Because we had so much fun and we did something I was really proud of. But like, I auditioned for Tour Co. The first time I auditioned, I got a call back, and I was the only one in my group who got a call back, and I didn't know anything about, like, I just went in there with no expectations, and I was like, all right, I'll do this thing. But I, when I didn't get the Tour Co., I was fine with it. I didn't have any desire to. I just liked the group I was with. So the fact we continued on and took classes and did more stuff together, that was more exciting to me than doing main stage. Same with like SNL. Like I would want to host SNL, not be in it. I just didn't have the desire to be like, I want to be in that situation, because I don't think art should be competitive or improv. I don't, like, to me, that's counter of like, I understand why, where it's like you're pitching ideas and all that. But to me, that didn't
work. But when you hear, you know, it's almost like a naive view of things, you know, because so many theaters that we worked in, you know, and there was this competitive nature. Like, totally. If you want to get ahead, you know, you've got to be competitive, because there's only X amount of jobs or X amount of spots or X amount of teams. Yeah. So how do you make peace with that? You know, for a student that's like in a system and they're like, right. Oh God, you know, that's easy for you to say.
Right,
you know,
right, right.
But I just got cut from my team, or, you know, UCB, there's like, I don't know, there's only so many people that make a Herald team. It's like 60 or something like that.
I guess I never wanted to get ahead. When you said, like, get ahead, I'm like, I don't think I ever wanted to get ahead in this thing. That was one. I was like, oh, yeah, I see you. And it's okay. Like, people should have goals. I just never had that goal of, like, I got to get on a thing. I got to get on a team. There's so many examples of people, like, who are amazing at what they do, who don't get on those teams. And, like, a building doesn't determine how good you are. It's a style thing. And when it's like Frank Caietti, who I would play with every day, is the fun, joyful player, auditioned for UCB teams and didn't get on it. And he was on Mad TV and he was on ETC and he didn't get it. And like, you know the story of Tina Fey, where she finished level E at Second City and auditioned for the conservatory. And of her class, she was the only one who didn't get into the conservatory.
I never knew that story.
Yeah, Kevin Riome was in her class and told me that. And he was like, I had the best audition of my life. I had no idea. But it's like Tina Fey didn't get, I mean, the groundlings, their level A or their intro class, their first class, they fail most of the people for
moving
on. So
why is it that we define ourselves by if we get into Second City, if we're on a UCB?
It's your ego. And it's like, I achieved, it's a transaction. And it's also set up as like, a lot of times too, when people, like when I would teach at Second City here, and it's like people would go on and they would be auditioning for the conservatory and then they wouldn't get and they'd be sad. And I'm like, that makes sense because you got rejected. But it's like, do you want to use improv to write political and satirical sketch comedy? They're like, no. And I'm like, well, then that's what the conservatory is, but you don't know anything else. And I think a lot of times, too, when people go through this, you bond with your group and then there's an ending to it, you know. And so there is a sadness because you're losing that part of it. It depends on what is you're defined as success. Now, I know you and I know you have you sometimes talk about like SNL and like what that would have been like and how you want, and you want to achieve fame, which is, there's nothing wrong with that for sure. I also look at it too, like you got your dream job. Would that make you happy?
I don't know. We'll find out. I'll call you. You'll be one of the first people.
I will.
I'm miserable.
But that's it.
What
like,
do I do with $2 million?
Right. And it's like, what defines success for you? And like,
but I think that's the difference between you and me. And that's the difference between the joy piece. It used to be when I started this podcast, I would figure out why someone was famous, you know. But now I'm more interested in joy. And I think part of it is, if you're truly happy, yeah, where you're at, and there's no, you know, regrets of the past or fear of the future, you're in the moment. And I don't care, and maybe this is going to be sound self-righteous or whatever, I don't care what kind of improv we do. I don't care if it's yes. I don't care, you know, if you're yes-ending or not. The bottom line is, are we in the moment? That if you broke the improv down, it's us just being in the moment. That's it. To the purest form. And to me, when I hear about your philosophy in life, you are living improv because you are in the moment. You don't fucking care if you're going to be on SNL. That doesn't bother you. You know, the hundreds of people that we worked with back in the late 80s who have now, they're now getting Academy Awards.
You see them on billboards.
Awards. Yes.
You're like, motherfucker.
You know, thank me. To me, that's the difference.
Well, but yes, but also it's not like, oh, I got this life figured out. It's like, no, you go through stuff and I think you're in a constant state of evolving, and you either regress or you continue to grow. And it's like, you know, it's very hard because it's very easy to start getting in your head and thinking about all this negative stuff or things that aren't happening or what. Like, it's very easy. It's very easy to get to the point. So it is work of like, okay, let me just check myself as we go.
But when I see you, you're at peace with being an improv teacher. And you came to my show, and afterwards, you're like, we were talking, and you said, you know, improv, we change people's lives.
Yeah.
Okay? You believe that. You believe that in every cell of your body. If I said that, it wouldn't be as believable.
But you know it's true. You change people's lives. You do.
Okay. But I have a hard time accepting that. You believe that. You know,
why do you have a hard time accepting that?
It's just the nature of who I am. But here's the thing about you is like when you said it was like your enthusiasm, you're passionate about it. Hmm. And my question to you is like, you've been doing this for, you know, a long time, way over 30 years, you know, and are close to it.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you still...
I love that. You're like way over 30 years. You're like, well, not yet, but close, very close. Yeah. Well,
you probably took your first class. How old are you now? You don't have to tell me the age because you're in Los Angeles.
My first, I got classes 1991. My first class was 92. January of 92 was my first class.
Like, well, so that's 18 plus...
It's 28. I mean, 20, it's pretty close to 30.
How do you keep that? You seem like, even in a lot of ways, you seem more passionate about improv now, mm-hmm, than even when we met 5 years ago.
No, that's true. And I think...
What's changed?
I think sometimes part of it is like, you got to get away. Like, I've had to take a break before... And then be like, okay, and then come back to it and come back to it more passionate about it. But there were times where it's like, yeah, when I was, because I started real young, and I was like, I needed to take a little bit of a break because I didn't balance it out with life. And so I was just so into it. I think that's what happens. A lot of people get so into it that it's like, you can't forget to still live your life and bring that part of it. And you have to look at it like, you know, what's the joy in it for you? Like, why are you still doing it? Like, you've been doing it longer than I have. So I'll ask, like, why are you still in it? Because there is, even though you, I think part of it too is like, I think you enjoy a little bit being that like curmudgeon, which is fine. But it's like, so maybe that's your joy. Maybe your joy, because you can't be in something this long and not have some joy in it. That joy might mask itself.
I think in the last couple of years, I enjoy teaching a lot more than I I led on to.
Yeah.
I mean, they're and I love how I teach, and it's different than how you teach, and mm-hmm. and I love that. And you know, before we were doing the interview, you know, my class was ending, and I said, and I don't know if you feel the same way. I'm starting to get I would say in the last probably 5 years or something, I'm getting people that want to study how I teach improv, and they're and I'm getting people that we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know that you know, maybe because of the podcast they hear I'm, you know, a little off, you know, or whatever. But that but that's, to me, that's very rewarding.
But I would say to that, absolutely, you're right. Also, you kind of said it yourself, which is like your view changed too. So mm-hmm. you have more joy, and I think it manifests itself. I think because you have that and you're putting it out there in the universe, even though you might not think it's a ton, but it's like, that's really not for you to say. It's like, no, you're putting that out there, and this is just my belief, is like things manifest. And it's like when I was like, I'm going to make the choice to have more joy or see that, then like a lot of the good stuff started happening, where it was like I was in a class, I was like, I'm going to make a choice. I believe in this. I have joy teaching it. I have fun. So that's how I'm going to teach it. I'm not going to teach it like person X does. It's the same way, like, I'm not going to perform. Like, I look at somebody who does, like, Koechner, who does good character work. It's like, okay, that's not me. And I've tried for a long time. It's like, I can't. I can only do this thing. So my characters take a different path than his does. Or you see Jamie Moyer or somebody like that, and it's like, wow, they can do these amazing things. And I have to just be more appreciative of that. And so with you saying, oh, in the past couple years, wow, I'm getting a lot of students here who like my style, it's like, well, but you're also changed to put it out there. And so now they're coming and you're getting more comfortable. You know, for those of you listening who want to teach, it's like that's another constant evolution. Like how you first start is different than how you
right. And then I would say the last 5 years, I mean, because of the sexual harassment stuff and the Me Too, and you know we've seen a real shift in the classrooms.
Yeah.
And how have you been able to adjust with that?
Well, that whole thing is a long time coming, and it's like I'm very passionate about, you have a position of authority in a classroom, and I think anything you do to harm that is unforgivable. You are promising people to come into a safe space, and if you are taking away from that safe space by your action, like that is to me like, man, that's something I strongly disagree with, and you need to take that as teachers. We need to take that seriously. We need to be like, this is a safe space. People are coming and being very vulnerable, and if you can't keep your hands off of people in your class, or you can't ask, like, you have to ask out a student, it's like, oh, that's ridiculous. Like, you there's 7.5 billion people on the earth. You're going to pick one of these 14 people where you're going to do that, because, you know, improvisers have a bunch of like misfits. We're all misfits, and we come in, and now you found a place where you feel accepted. So now it's like some of these misfits then take that little bit of power, like some humans do, where it's like you take a little bit of power and you blow it out of proportion. Now, because for whatever stuff you have going on in your life, now you're bringing that in. It's like, I think that's completely inappropriate. And I think the landscape is changing. And as teachers, we need to change with it. There are exercises I don't do anymore that I used to do. I used to do this exercise where it's like later on when people were in like a level 3 or 4 or 5, and I would circle up and I'm like, I want you to play. And I would take them through like, first I'd be like, yell at each other. Then I'd be like, call each other names. And I would slowly take them through like doing stereotypes and things like that. And it would get a little bit uncomfortable. It's an exercise I learned from Martin DeMott, because at the end I would be like, great, now how was that? And it was like, oh, that was terrible. It's like, great, we never do those again. We never do that. But I don't do that exercise anymore, because I don't think it has the same effectiveness. And you have to worry about things like things that trigger people, and you have to have these conversations, and you have to, you know, now I ask, when I teach a workshop, I'll ask, you know, I'll email out students. I'll be like, are there things that trigger you? Just because I'm like, if that's adding to a safe space where there are things we don't do that I might have done before, then okay, then that challenges me as a teacher to do something different. Like sometimes I don't even teach the game. And again, this is works for me. And I know some people would be like, we should be able to do this and that. It's like, that's fine. Do that for you. Like I get uncomfortable even doing a game like Arms Expert, which is a short form game where So it's a short form game, and you basically like somebody takes you put your arms behind your back, and somebody else becomes your arms behind you, and they are your arms, and it's a good game for like justifying. But I've stopped doing that because of people have different personal space issues, and so I can do other justification games that don't involve that so that it's a safe space. Because I also started looking at, if you look at classes, they start off a lot of times with more women than men. And then as it goes up, it's almost all men. So it's like, okay, as teachers and as theaters and even people in classes, to be aware of like, why is this happening? Why we're losing a huge segment of our population. And so like, what is the reason this is happening? If there's something I can do that doesn't.
What do you think the reason is?
I think it's because, you know, it's a aggressive play by men. I think men at times tend to talk over, and this is a generalization, but in my experience, it's like men play more aggressively, and men also like, there are little things that keep happening that are actually big things, but it's like telling someone to shut up in a scene, or calling someone a bitch, or being like, oh, this woman who in class, in real life, she's in her 50s, but in the scene, she keeps being told she's a mom or grandma. And eventually it's like, I don't want to do that. And so they leave because it also doesn't feel safe. It doesn't feel like they can be creative. And in level one, you have more of that feeling. But then as it goes, teachers need to be aware of these things to be able to look at them and say, okay, I have to be very proactive in making sure that this is a safe area for people to play in, because then it allows more growth. And we should hold ourselves accountable. And that also includes like other teachers, but then also students too, is to be like, to not be afraid to say something as it goes, because we have to take care of each other. You know, improv is a very feminine art form where we take care of each other. And that goes back to Viola Spolin and Neva Boyd. And they were the ones that, like, Viola Spolin created all these improv games to help, a lot of the, was to help immigrant children assimilate into America in Chicago in like the 30s and or 20s, 30s, 40s. And her son is Paul Sills, and people forget, and Paul Sills founded the Second City, and people forget her name a ton. It's like, no, she's a huge part of what we do. So as teachers, we need to just always be like, okay, like training ourselves in West Side Comedy Theater in Santa Monica.
Which you teach there.
Where I teach there was the first theater where they made everyone go through sexual harassment, like a training.
And this was years ago before.
This was right when I moved to LA. They were like, if you're going to teach here, you have to go through this. And Second City hadn't done that at that time. Like, none of the places I taught at before had done that. And it was very important to be like, cool. And then we at West Side read a statement to this and have everybody sign it. It's like, it's a zero tolerance. And if you feel unsafe, here are some people you can talk to. Here are some people, if you don't feel comfortable talking to me, here are people at the theater who you can go talk to. And here's somebody who is a professional who you can deal with. So just to make sure that we're saying what we brought people in for, which is like, this is going to be a safe place to have fun. And we have to do that because times just change. And if you aren't changing with the times, if you aren't seeing that as something important, then you should really reevaluate what you're doing as you go. And I think a lot of times the students want to look to the teacher. They want to make sure they're doing the right scene. They want to make sure they're getting it right. They want to please you as you're doing that. So it is a position of authority, and you have to treat it like it's a job.
What makes a good improv teacher?
Passion for it is the first thing. Another is allowing the people to see what's already inside of them and allowing them to trust themselves as they go, I think is a big part of it. Noticing, like, being able to help them achieve what they're trying to do and steer them and give them feedback in a way that will help them with that. Making sure that you're not using improv so that they feel bad about themselves. Like, improv should not make you feel bad about who you are. Like, that's not what it's there for. So I think having...
How do you... Because I've as a teacher, you know, people will come to me because I like people to speak their process. If they're, you know, if they're frustrated or whatever, to let, and people will be like, oh, last week was really frustrated and I felt bad about the class. And sometimes those classes turn out to be the ones that they learn the most with.
Yeah.
So how do you do it where it's like there is always going to be people that are going to leave going, oh, that really sucked. I wasn't very good. And you know, also be like, okay, this is fun.
Yeah. I mean,
how do you work that balance in?
Well, I think, you know, first off, students ask me like questions a bunch of like, in this situation, when this happens, what do you do? And I frustrate them because I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea. You make the choice you make in that situation. You're going to have these moments where you're still growing and learning, even though it's like, oh, that was a bad class. But like bad class meaning like it was very hard. It's like, yeah, you're feeling that way because it's growing pains and you're doing this thing. And like, did they come back to your class? Then you're doing a good job. That they come back, like, and you tell them as you go, you know, and you know, it depends on the class. Sometimes you're like, okay, this is going to be a hard concept to understand, but we're working on this. And so here, this is the thing. Sometimes as a teacher, I'll sit there and it's like at the end of the exercise or midway through, I'll be like, okay, stop. I did not explain that well, or this is not going the way I thought it was, or this is my fault. Like you not being afraid to say, I fucked up. I fucked that exercise up. This is not. Or you look at it and you're adjusting mid-class and you're like, this class isn't ready to do this thing. It's not their fault. It's just like, oh, they're not ready for it. So then, you know, one of the best pieces of advice I got was like, over-prepare, then throw it out the window and teach to the class. Like, I write down a ton of exercises. I look at the class and I'm like, I think this will help them. I think this will lead to this really cool exercise as they go. And that just goes with experience. But I still get so much joy watching people. And even when they fail, you set it up, it's a safe place. And if they fail and you're clapping or you're encouraging them, then they won't see it as much as a failure. They'll see it as like, oh, this is leading to something else. So as you're in those situations and it's like, how do you get them to see the validity in that process and see that what they're doing is going to lead them to a good place. And I think it's like you said, it's you're telling them like this is part of a process. Or like, you know, I have a buddy who teaches at UCB and he's like, I don't like teaching Game of Scene, which is what they're known for. He goes, the students don't like learning it. I don't like teaching it. So anytime I do an intensive, it's like the last day. It's like, yeah, because it's a very hard thing to do. It's like, you know, Game of Scene is like the most heady thing because you're trying to recognize that. So I think you sit there and you try to make it a place like you make it you teach the class that you. For me, I teach a class and I look at it as like, how can I help people get the most out of this? And it also deals with how do you give feedback to people?
How do you give feedback?
Here's what I do, which has helped me. Like the first day of any class I do usually, level one, two, experienced, I go, all right, we're going to play TV tag.
You know, the old TV tag, yeah, we run around the room. I have to come up with a TV show. If I don't come up with a TV show, if I don't say Different Strokes,
right,
which was a TV show a long time ago, and you tag me before I say the thing, then I become it.
Yeah.
And we go around that way.
And thank you for that Different Strokes reference.
Thank
That's
you.
In my wheelhouse.
Okay.
Because what I'm doing when I'm doing that is I'm assessing their level of play. Like, where are they? Because now I can look around, I'm like, okay, cool. I see this person is a little nervous and scared, so I know how to give them notes. This person's running around like a maniac. I love it. They have no fear. I know how to get. So I'm assessing from the beginning of, like, how do I give notes?
Which we'll get more to the notes. But I think that's also really important and something we can agree on is I think people think, like, oh, warm-up games, the short shift. We don't need to spend time on warm-up games. But I'm the same way. I'm with the warm-up games, I'm already assessing, oh, is this person trying to be controlling? Yes. Is this person trying to dominate? Is this person, is he trying to invent something versus discovery? Right. Is this person laying back? So now I'm going to have to be conscious of, make sure they get in. And I don't think enough people put importance on the warm-up games.
Oh, I mean, when the greatest team of all time, the Chicago Bulls, when they would come out on a basketball court, the first thing they do is they would dribble and do layups. And that's the most remedial thing, but it was part of the warm-up. And to me, I'm like, you need to warm up because it's a muscle. You need to get to a sense of play. And for me, personally, I need to get out of my week and try to stay present. And to get in a sense of play. And I know people are like, oh, well, it's like, but you're not ready to, especially if you're doing a show. I don't understand how people can't. Now, I've warmed up in 5 seconds. Like, you get to a venue and it's like, you're on now. And it's like, great, let's zip zaps up quick. And that goes back to my short form training. It's like, that's a focus up issue. Let's focus up very quickly, ready to go on. But it's like, to not warm up to me is like you're going to see a band and then they just step on stage. It's like they start blowing into their instruments and you're like, you didn't warm up at all. So we need to do that. So to me, it is a very important part of this. And people warm up differently. There were shows where I warm up by just talking to people. It's like, how have you been? Like, that's a warm up. There are other shows too where it's like, okay, I need to get out there and be physical or silly or something.
Is gossiping about Second City, is that still a warm-up game before a show?
That's the only warm-up. No. Now it's gossiping about a certain woman who runs a theater in Chicago. Okay. It's like you can't get two improvisers together without them talking about that person. It's like,
right. Yeah.
And it's like, and that does, like, again, all of that stuff. And it's easy to fall into. I'd do it. It's easy to fall into. But it's like, you're not, I guess part of it too is like, I'm not putting positive energy out there.
I agree with you because certainly I've been guilty of that. And you know, talking, you know, whatever, gossiping or whatever. And it does take something away from your focus. It really does. Yeah. It kind of like saps your energy.
Totally.
But it's like a drug. At the time, you feel like you're getting high off of it.
And you're getting a little hit.
Yeah.
You're getting a little hit. And it's also like, oh, as long as we're talking about that, we're not talking about me.
Right.
And we can all hop on that. And it's like, I don't need to have any more conversations about certain things regarding improv.
Right.
Because also, like, anytime I think about, like, this theater style or that theater style or any of that stuff, it's always like, don't forget, years ago, nobody knew anything about improv. And your bit in your show made me laugh so hard where you were saying, like, well, it's kind of like, have you ever seen SNL? It's like that, but we make it up. And
when
you're explaining to some people about improv, I laugh so hard because I've had those conversations where people don't know what improv is, and how you said it in your show is perfect. You're trying to tell them, it's not like stand-up. It's not like sketch. So the fact that anybody knows about improv now, or that we're in the zeitgeist, or that, like, SNL does a Chicago improv thing, or BoJack Horseman does. Have you seen BoJack Horseman? Have you watched that? So I would encourage you to watch it. It's great, but they do this whole run on.
What is it?
So it's a cartoon on Netflix. It's an animated series. And basically, Will Arnett voices BoJack Horseman, who's a horse. That is a talking horse, wears a sport jacket. Had a big hit show in, like, the 80s, like Full House, kind of like a Full House. And then he lives in the Hollywood Hills, and he's trying to make a comeback into TV and film. And it can be very sad also. It's a
love
funny.
Sad comedy. It's love,
a,
sad
you
comedy.
You love it. But in one scene, a couple years into it, he's got this guy, Todd, who's, like, kind of a homeless kid who stayed on his couch one night but then still lives there. And Amy Sedaris plays his agent, who's a cat. I mean, it's a wonderful show. But one day, Todd is walking down the street and he sees a sign for Scientology. It's like, change your life, take a personality test. He's like, oh, okay. And he goes to walk in, and a guy pops out and goes, have you ever seen improv? And he goes, no. So then he makes a turn into improv, and it's the parallels between improv and Scientology are so close, because it's like, well, you're always going up levels. You never graduate. They had a guy on a ship, a guru on a ship, and I think you would really enjoy it because it was like, oh, right. Like, it is that thing now that people know about improv, whereas before they still had no idea. So the fact anybody knows about it I love. I get upset when people hate, when people are don't leave improv with a good taste in their mouth because of theaters or teachers have a bad impact. That gets me upset because I'm like, it's cool if you've tried. Like I had a student who his name is Tim. He took
Tim R.
It is Tim R.
Okay.
It actually is Tim R.
Okay.
Tim Ruddle. And he took three levels of improv at Second City, did the show, and it was really good, like very funny. And then after the show, it was like, I was like, who's signing up to go on a level four? He's like, no. I'm like, why not? And he goes, I'm going to go take a glass blowing class. And I was like, cool. Like, he just liked taking classes.
Right.
He didn't leave, at least as far as I know, he didn't leave because it was like, oh, I feel bad about this. And so I get upset when people leave improv or have a bad experience because it's like, it's cool if you're like, I tried it, maybe not for me. Like, that's fine. But when people leave because of a theater or because of a teacher or because of any reason where they leave and it's not a good situation, that makes me upset. That's something I'm passionate about.
Right. The student that I enjoy working with is someone who's been through the systems. They've kind of been there. They're like, oh, I'm going to work with you. And that thing of like getting them, and it's amazing that I can do it in other people's lives except mine, that they get that joy back. They get that joy back.
So you do affect people.
I do affect people.
Yes.
Those kind of people, that to me is the most satisfying. Is like those, and they're usually very talented and very skilled. You know, like, because maybe they were on teams for a couple of years and whatever, and for whatever reason, like you said, they had a bad experience, and then they come here where it's not as much pressure, and I work a little different way, and they get that joy and that fun back, and that to me is like, it's super rewarding, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's why we still do it, is because we affect people's lives. I really think that way. I don't think it's like people that go on to do things in entertainment who you've taught are great. Like, it's wonderful. But the most enjoyment I get are people who say, my life's better. Or improv rehab, where they're like, oh, I came from theater X and I hated it. And it's like, I came here and I brought the passion again. And it's like, sometimes a theater, you know, again, it's a style thing. To me, the judge of you as an improviser is who wants to play with you. And if you have people who want to play with you, it's so much more of a judge than like, I made this team at this space. They allowed me to perform because like a lot of times when you're in those situations where it's like a competition to get on a team, the team's going to end. And sometimes like the best people get on a team. They go through a training program for a year. They get on a team. They do three shows in 4 months and then the team's cut. And then they're thinking it's a reflection on them. It's like, no, it's not. There's a limited amount of space. This style that they want, which sometimes isn't conveyed to you, sometimes in the training center is do it this way. But then, well, wait a minute. The people on stage are doing it a different way.
Right.
Which is like, okay. But you forget a lot of times, too. I think we forget they're training centers. They're not guarantees of anything, and they don't owe you anything. And like, if you can resolve that in yourself, and again, you should have goals to be like, I want to be on a team for sure. Like, absolutely, there's nothing wrong with having those goals. Or I want to be on TV. Or like I think you know, like Andy Richter. I think like from what I remember, he was always like, I want to be on TV, and then he got on TV. You know, it wasn't like I want to be a great improviser.
But the interesting thing about Andy was because there was two. You know, I worked with two people that Dave Koechner and Andy Richter. Yeah. And I'll never forget a time, and it just kind of shows how it can happen for different people. Dave's always the guy like, I'm not working hard enough. I got to get in an acting class. And I remember they were in the back of my parents' station wagon, and Andy's like, really? You have to do it that way? Like, Andy was one of those guys who would literally showed up and could just be funny, and he didn't have that same, you know, he had a different kind of drive than Dave did.
Yeah.
But they both ended up, you know, in pretty good places.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think taking a healthy view of, like, whether it's, like, Dave or Andy, where they were, you know, Dave's like, I'm going to take a class, I'm going to keep training. Like, that, I think, is really good. I think people, you know, sometimes you get in this situation, it's like, I'm going to get on a team. and you have so much focus on that and that grip on that team. And then it's like, okay, let's say you get it or don't get it. Like, that's not going to satisfy you. That's like, you're always going to be looking for something else. Like, I remember our friend Shad Kunkel was like, so he moved here to do improv. He's like the funniest guy. Like,
very funny. Just a great improviser, great person.
I mean, like, if somebody's like, you're going to die unless you do one really good improv scene, I might be like, I'll do it with Shad because I know he's going to crush it. But he, for years, was just like, I got to get Second City. I got to get Second City. And he was holding on to it so tight that it took him a while to get it. Shad's very funny because Shad also got Main Stage, but it wasn't the way he wanted to. So it's like, but you forget the success of doing, like, you moved here to do it. You did it. And I don't think a lot of times we look at that as a success. And the same with, like, going to an improv class is a big deal. Like, signing up to go into a class where you don't know anybody, you don't know what's going on, that's a huge deal. I think sometimes people forget going through it is no guarantee for you to be on the stage. Like, Second City, I feel like going through Second City, when I went through it, I think the attitude a lot was like, oh, it's not, like, some small percentage will get there, but it's like you're learning stuff here. I feel like in the early days with I.O., the attraction was you get on stage the fastest. And so then people got on stage, and that became more of a thing of like, it's a means to an end, where it's like, oh, I go through the training center, I get on a team. And that was, to me, that was the difference between the two. And now it's like, you know, you go through these training programs, and it's like there's no guarantee of anything. Like, if you were going through I.O. now, if you enrolled now, Jimmy, at the same time you did back when you originally did, do you think you'd get on a team?
No.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm like, I don't know.
I don't think no, definitely. I would not get on a team.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, and so.
I don't know if I'd get on a team now at 50. You know what I'm saying? You know? Well. Because it's a different generation. It's a different style.
But if you went to Noah and you said to him, which I don't think you ever would do, but if you did go to him, you said,
No, Gregoropoulos. Like the top teacher over there.
Top teacher over there. Or you went to somebody like that. Or even Sharon. Like, if you went to some of these people, mm-hmm. I think you would be on a team. I don't think you would go ask them. But I think if it was like, oh, I want to be on a team, if you said that to yourself right now, which then I would say to you, Jimmy, you got a daughter and you're married. What the fuck are you going to do?
Well, what I really want is tour course.
Yeah,
Second
you
City.
Get there. You're close.
Because it's a paying gig.
You're close.
Am I on the list?
You should get on the boat.
Okay.
Oh, wait.
They don't have boats anymore.
But you, dude, you could be on Green Coat real soon.
Really? Okay.
Hide a bed. Pictionary.
Right.
But I think if you went there, like, I think, but that's not, you know, you change. And that's not the goal. And my goal right now is not like, I think I like teaching when there's no, you're going to make a team. Unless it's a theater I have, like when I was in Denmark, it was like, oh, I was teaching people knowing here's the style. And I felt like, oh, you should come in level one and then you should learn a style that then gets you, that's the style. So it's like, what's the style of your theater? You learn it and then you put the people on the team.
Well, and that's why I think, you know, for people like us who also teach for ourselves and also smaller theaters in bigger markets, these places have gotten so big that what we had when we were doing stuff is you'd go to a theater and immediately it was 30 people doing it or 40 people. And there was this instant community, you know?
Yeah.
And now that's not the case. I mean, these training centers are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, and there's tons of teams, and there's multiple theaters, you know? And so you don't, you know, you go to the Christmas party, it's 200 people and you don't know those people. And I think, you know, what these smaller theaters and people like us who are teaching can provide is that community that we had when we started out. Because that's the thing that I think, you know, and I saw an interview that you did with when you started improv, you found your tribe.
Yeah.
And I felt the same way. Here are these like-minded people. We're all fuck-ups. And now we're being rewarded for what we have been punished for,
right,
you know, in
right,
school
right.
and in our families. And so that's the thing that attract it was that community that I it's probably one of the reasons I haven't left, you know.
Of course it is. And I keep thinking to myself, as long as person X is doing it, like there's somebody in my mind where it's like, as long as they're doing it, I'm fine because I'm not the oldest person, and it's not you, but there's someone else where I'm like, oh, as long as person X is doing it.
Well, Noah is probably no, there's people old, even
there's
older.
There's people older than, so as long as it's like, okay, cool. But it is that thing of like you find you're right. It's like you found those like-minded people, and that's also helped me in life is because of improv, you have these people that are misfits and we're the, you know, the island of misfit toys. And you find people where you're like, oh, you might be a different age than me, but you have that same idea. And because humans want that connection. And whether it's improv or Dungeons and Dragons or a sewing circle or church or anything like that, it's like people find their tribe. And it's like, who's your tribe? And it's like mine just happened to be these improvisers who now as I continue to go and it gets more known and everything, and you go into these situations where it's like, you know, you teach a corporate workshop, and now in these corporate workshops, there are starting to be people who it's like, I saw I taught one once, and a guy in the class I had in my class. And so you start seeing these people now more often where you're like, oh, we're kind of, these people are all over. And the more I go to other cities, like in Copenhagen, it's like, oh, I found my tribe there. And it's the same people. They're just from different countries. But it's the same. I look at somebody like, oh, that person reminds me of this person. That person is this person. You find people and you're like, oh, my goodness, this person is amazing. And I would tell them, like, if you're really into improv, go. You will be able to play right away whatever city you're in because you're that good. But you find those people.
Where do you think, because you've been to, and we got to wrap this up because we're going long, but I'm enjoying this so much. I hope I'm not holding you hostage here.
Holding me hostage.
The thing is, because I said it was an hour, and now it's, you know, four. It's, you know, now we're into Friday here in Chicago. We started it Wednesday. But where do you see improv going? And I talked a little about here, I feel in a lot of ways that the bubble has kind of burst for the regular classes and for the actor and the improviser.
Yeah.
It seems like it's burst. What sense are you getting in terms of the direction improv is going?
I think with books, with podcasts like this one, with YouTube and all that stuff, I think it's going to grow globally more. Like, I think there are a lot of places around the world where it's like, oh, it's not fully developed there. So I think it'll start taking off in those places. I think it'll start being more effective and more used in corporate training as far as because you're talking about a mindset or behavior change. So I think that's definitely going to be something that it's going to take off and even more. It's going to be seen as a viable training. I think for actors, it's a necessity now. So I think there is still going to be that element where actors will have to do it because casting directors and agents are saying, like, you have to, like, it's no longer it's no longer like a, oh, you can take it. It's like, no, you need it. So I think that'll happen. I think we haven't tapped into, like, what it can be done with technology. Like, what, you know, there are, it's getting close to where you can enjoy improv recorded. But I think it's like, oh, there's a use where it can be like almost using virtual reality to create shows. I've always wanted to do a show, and it's starting to get that way, but where it's like you're here, I'm in a different city completely, but we have the technology to make it look like we're in the same place and people can come watch it. So I think like technology is very exciting to be like, where can it go with technology? But I think it's always going to, I think it's just settling a little bit. I think it's gone from a high mark for sure. I think it'll come back down and settle a little bit, but I don't think it's ever going to go away. I think it's always just going to continue to evolve and change. And then something, you know, like when Whose Line Is It Anyway came, it changed the landscape because now people had a reference for it. Now people are like, oh, I've seen, it's like, have you seen Whose Line Is It? And it was like, now people got it. And so I think there will be something else moving forward with it. It's just interesting to be like, where's that going to happen? I think teaching will start happening, like there'll be training online. And I'm doing a lot of like Skype sessions now where I teach people from all over, which is amazing. Like you can teach people from all over the world, but I think it also will go into like some sort of you know, there'll be some sort of like virtual vault of information where it's like, oh, you want to learn this skill? Here's a place you can go watch it. So I think it's all going to change. I think it's also like when you have improv in other countries, they aren't always limited by what you see when you go to a city like Chicago that's very saturated with improv. You tend to see a lot of the same kind of stuff. But when you're in a place where you don't have that, two things happen. One is you find something and you do the same thing. Like when I was in Copenhagen, they did a lot of scene painting openings because that's all they really saw. They did that.
I see a guy in a sweater.
Right. Like there's a
cat
mirror
poster in the back.
Right. Right.
Coffee table with, you know, cocaine on it.
Right. You're describing a room or a character, which from my understanding is just a technique from the movie, which was an improvised, where they had to describe it.
They'd improvise an actual movie.
They'd improvise a movie.
They'd do the opening credits and the
camera swings and sees this. So that's all like scene painting. And so now I'm like, oh, so that happens. And then the other thing is like people do stuff because they don't know the limitations. So they're like, all right, let's try this. And then some really cool stuff happens because it isn't done and they have a different reference level. So I think it's always going to constantly grow and evolve. I think it's interesting that like some, you know, like that the Herald is so big right now because I'm like, I don't know if you know, like Del Close would be for or against that if it's like, oh, you're still doing the Herald, or if it would have, you know, evolved past that. But it's a very effective instrument in improv, but I think there's always room to expand and grow things. So I think that's what's going to happen.
We got to end the podcast because it's
the podcast. This is the last Improv Nerd ever.
Yeah.
We're ending the podcast.
Yes, we're ending the podcast. You've got an exclusive here. So what one piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
What do you think? Stay positive. Again, I always go back to like play the love. Like what's the love? Like stay positive. And as you're continuing, like try to stay in the moment with also your training, and like there's no race. There's no place to go. Like enjoy the moment, especially when you're failing. Embrace that failure, play, you know, bring more of that love into it, and including love of yourself. And like, yes, and starts with you. You have to yes, and your ideas and your instincts and, you know, don't let anybody rain on your parade. As you're going through classes, you have to be in class with people who are there because they're paying to be there. But then once you get past that point, find the people who understand you and make you laugh. Bring the joy. Again, it's the joy thing. Like, we need more laughter. We need more of that. We need more silliness. So maintain the joy and make positive choices because they lead to interesting scenes. They're so much more interesting than that.
Jay Sukel, thank you for being our guest on the last episode of Improv Nerd. I love you. Thank you.
Love you, Jimmy.
There you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Jay Sukel, for taking on this interview was close to an hour and a half. And I also want to thank Andrew Gallant at Green Shirt Studio. They're an acting studio that I teach out of. They let me use the space. And I feel terrible because we were only supposed to go an hour. And it was like 9:30 at night when we filmed this. And we went to about 10 after 11. So, Andrew Gallant, thank you so much. And check out Green Shirt Studios. They've got great acting classes. Also, I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher, who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, you want to sign up for our newsletter. Each week we send out a blog that'll help you become a better improviser and a better actor. Or if you want information about my Artist Low Comedy classes and summer intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. We're also all over social media. We have an Improv Nerd Facebook page, so like us because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, we are on Twitter, improv_nerd, so follow us there. We're on an Instagram page. Thank God I have these interns that got me onto Instagram because I'm an old guy and I don't understand Instagram, and that's at Jimmy Corain. Also, check out our Patreon page, which is a nice thing if you're looking to become a better improviser or a better improviser teacher. There's masterclass lessons, video masterclass lessons you can check out there. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.